Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 3rd, 2010. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. From the top of the fold, first article today is Duke Aims to Expand Eye Care Offerings by James Gallagher from Durham. Duke University Health System has identified its next major construction project, even though it is still years away from completing a new patient tower and cancer hospital. The health system has begun pre-development work for a new eye care center that would largely replace the existing Wadsworth building. The proposed facility would be about 100,000 square feet, with about 10,000 existing square feet being renovated. The expansion is needed to keep pace with growing demand for eye care services, as well as to expand physician training, says Dr. David Epstein, chair of Duke's Department of Ophthalmology. At this point, the cost of the project remains largely unknown. Officials have filed with the state Certificate of Need Office for permission to spend $3.8 million on development planning. The CON system works to constrain healthcare cost growth by regulating capital spending. The early work, plus some of the construction, is being funded by a $12 million gift from LC Industries, a Durham nonprofit that employs people with impaired vision. Duke Health Planning Director Duncan Yagi says that until that development work is done, it's difficult to put a price tag on the project. It can be extraordinarily expensive or not so expensive, he says. The trick with that is to know what equipment is bought and put into it. Vision problems such as cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration become more prevalent as people age. And since more people are living longer, coupled with the baby boomer generation reaching retirement age, the number of people suffering from eye ailments is growing. Dr. David Durfee, Senior Secretary for Practice Management with the American Academy of Ophthalmology, says there are more patients needing care than ever. At the same time, advancements in medical technology have enabled ophthalmologists to treat diseases that previously were untreatable. Epstein says lasers can be used to treat glaucoma and cataracts, while injections into the eye can improve sight for those suffering from macular degeneration. Duke's existing eye care center is not equipped to meet demand. The current building, which is about 40 years old, was designed for 13 doctors and about 15,000 patients a year. The center now has 50 doctors, plus medical students and fellows, and sees more than 80,000 patients a year. Epstein says the center has a backlog of patients waiting to receive eye exams. Additionally, the building is poorly designed, making it difficult on patients who have trouble seeing, says Epstein, adding that despite their limited vision, many of their patients know the facility is in relatively poor condition. The limited space makes it hard for Duke to train new ophthalmologists and optometrists, two fields in great demand but limited supply. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services projects that the number of full-time equivalent ophthalmologists will fall by 1% between 2005 and 2020, from 17,440 to 17,350. Epstein says a new facility would give the center the space needed to train more doctors, though funding those programs is another issue. The expansion of the eye care center would add to a lengthy list of capital projects on Duke's main campus. The health system is currently constructing a new patient tower and cancer hospital, which combined will cost close to $1 billion. The cancer hospital is scheduled to open in 2012, while the patient tower would be wrapped up in 2013. And Duke School of Medicine is in the process of constructing a $53 million academic building that is located on the hospital's main campus. That facility is slated to open in 2013. Next up on the front page, MCNC Milking Endowment for Internet Project by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Managers of MCNC in Research Triangle Park have been drawing on the nonprofit's $45 million endowment, and may go back to the same source again to help pay for a massive broadband fiber optic network in 79 rural North Carolina counties. Managers have siphoned $8 million from the investment fund and in recent weeks have considered moving part of the money out of longer-term investments in case more cash is needed to get the job done. The nonprofit CEO, Joe Fredoso, says the step was taken because MCNC, once known as the Microelectronics Center of North Carolina, rated the broadband project too important to pass up. $104 million of the $142 million cost come from federal stimulus dollars, and because of the state's precarious financial position, the money is needed. Look at the budget situation. We just didn't want to go to the legislature for the money, said Fredoso. The withdrawals aren't expected to put too much stress on the group's endowment, which has hovered between $45 million and $52 million in recent years. A decade ago, when the investment fund was set up, it was the most controversial pots of cash in North Carolina. The story goes back to MCNC's beginnings in 1980. Started as a state-funded supercomputing center and startup incubator, the organization had received around $280 million in tax dollars by 1999, when state lawmakers stopped the funding, ushering in a period of layoffs and belt-tightening. MCNC had an ace in the hole, though, in the form of one of the computer chip startups it was incubating. Kronos Integrated Microsystems, which was acquired by JDS Uniphase Corporation in 2000 in a stock deal, valued at $750 million. MCNC's initial payday from the sale was about $160 million. Lawmakers, eager to get a portion of the proceeds for the state, discovered they'd lost their leverage when they halted state funding of MCNC. Moreover, a search of the original agreement between the state and MCNC turned up no provision in which the state would get a payoff if one of the startups actually paid off. The void subsequently led to action. To ensure it wouldn't come up on the short end of the stick again, the state ironed out an agreement between itself and its other large economic development nonprofit, the NC Biotechnology Center, according to the General Assembly fiscal researcher Kristen Walker. Under that arrangement, the state shares half of any of the profits exceeding $100,000. As for MCNC, its windfall's safe from the outside. The agency decided to put its Kronos winnings into an endowment to support the nonprofit into perpetuity. A decade later, after a split up of the old MCNC organization and several periodic and significant drawdowns to support the development of the agency's statewide research and educational IT network, the current $45 million investment fund is what remains of the initial $160 million. Like everyone else, we have sometimes taken our hits, says Fredoso, adding that the money is split among stocks, bonds, real estate, natural resources, and private equity. The current 20% allocation in real estate, natural resources, and private equity now are coming under review, with a discussion about whether to reassign a portion of those dollars into more liquid stocks and bonds that could be exited more easily if more cash is needed. Future withdrawals will come only after much review, says MCNC board member Jane Smith Patterson. No one is going to give us any money anymore, and we don't have other startups in the incubator, she says. As for the broadband project, she agrees it was just too important to pass up, and it's intended to reach some underserved rural areas, she says. Once completed, the network has the potential to serve more than 1,500 anchor institutions, including schools, 180,000 businesses, and more than 300,000 families, mostly in the eastern part of the state. The lead article in this week's front page Triangle Business Journal, RDU Pines to Go West. RDU's wish list includes L.A., Kansas City, and Seattle, by Chris Basden. From Morrisville, the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority will unveil an air service study this month that's expected to identify Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, Seattle, and Kansas City as RDU's most coveted markets for new service. Airport officials will use the findings in the report to lobby carriers to provide nonstop flights to those areas. It will help prioritize what service we need, says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamblin. The study was done by Barry Clark, an aviation consultant from Texas, for about $50,000. Clark began work on the study in July. Hamblin says the last study was completed 5 years ago. Just a few weeks ago, RDU thought it had addressed one of its biggest unmet needs, nonstop service to Los Angeles. But Delta Airlines cut that LAX flight from its schedule at the end of November. The Atlanta-based carrier says the elimination of the flight is just a seasonal change. Though spokesman Paul Skirbick says Delta hasn't determined a date when nonstop service will resume. Delta's decision on the RDU LAX route is perplexing to Clark, who says the market is certainly big enough to support it. The air service study will provide ammunition for Teresa Dominano, RDU's top air service recruiter, when she meets with carriers. But the data in there has its persuasive limits, as Delta's nixing of the LAX flight, temporarily though it might be, illustrates. There are a lot of factors at play in route selection. The number of passengers traveling to a location is an important one, as is a flight's load factor, the percentage of seats that are filled. But carriers also have to consider everything from airport incentives to the fallout from the economic downturn to the industry's recent consolidation. Airlines dealing with RDU probably won't have to take incentives into consideration, as the airport has eschewed using them in recent years. Asked about the factors it considers when adopting a new route, Delta Skirbick writes in an email, "We look for broad support from communities from both the business and leisure travel sectors to offer routes that can be sustained over time." L.A. isn't the only city on RDU's list of top unserved markets to have had service before. Southwest Airlines in 2001 and 2002, and ExpressJet 2007 and 2008, both tried their hand at an RDU Kansas City route, number 5 on the list, but eventually gave it up. RDU has never had a nonstop flight to number 2, San Francisco. But Midway Airlines, which had a hub at RDU before going out of business early in the decade, did operate a flight to nearby San Jose from November 2000 until August 2001. The disappearance of Midway and its regional partner, Corporate Airlines, from RDU led to the loss of many routes that RDU hasn't been able to replace on a permanent basis in the past decade. Those include Columbia, South Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, New Bern, Wilmington, and West Palm Beach, Florida. Other destinations that have been lost over the years, some served by Midway, some not, include Austin, Texas, Asheville, Greenville, South Carolina, New Orleans, Ottawa, Richmond, Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia, Salt Lake City, and Charleston, South Carolina. RDU hasn't just lost destinations, it's also seen a dramatic decline in the overall number of flights as carriers around the country have cut capacity in the wake of the recent recession. Back in 2000, the airport had 288.5 daily departures to 50 destinations. One flight only operated a couple times a week, hence the 0.5 departure. Today, there are 185 daily departures to 37 locations. The losses that have been somewhat mitigated over the past decade by the additions of new service to destinations including Denver, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. Continuing to the bottom of the front page, North Carolina State University collects Hillsborough Street parcels for improvement by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. North Carolina State University officials have quietly acquired nearly 2 acres of developed and vacant land across Hillsborough Street from the university's iconic bell tower and are looking for private developers to spiff up the sites. Trustees of the Endowment Fund of North Carolina State University paid about $2.7 million to assemble much of the privately owned property over the past 2 years. The properties include vacant parcels abutting newly opened Hillsborough Street roundabouts, as well as the 2110 Hillsborough Street retail and office building that opened in the 1960s, and the Delta Upsilon fraternity house on Maiden Lane. In total, the properties cover about 1.8 acres, with additional expansion opportunities possible along the city block between the properties. The university is seeking investors who could privately finance, design, build, and market a mixed-use development project with parking on Hillsborough Street, says Ralph Retchie, director of University Real Estate for NC State. A formal request for qualifications went out in November, and submissions are due December 20th. Retchie says notifications and requests for proposal from select applicants will go out in March. Our intent was to acquire some properties under various ownerships that, when combined, would create a great opportunity site, Retchie says. In September, the city completed a $10 million improvement of Hillsborough Street that included construction of two traffic circles, new sidewalks, and street lighting and the burying of utility cables. Completion of the year-long Hillsborough Street project gives great cause to move forward now, Retchie says. There's a whole attitude that's different from 2 years ago. City and university leaders have long lamented a frequent turnover of retail, restaurant, and service tenants along Hillsborough Street, and a gradual deterioration of the buildings across from campus. Groups including the Hillsborough Street Partnership and the Hillsborough Street Community Service Corp were formed to encourage new investment on both private and public properties along the corridor that stretches from downtown Raleigh to the Meredith College campus. Jeff Murison, executive director of the Hillsborough Street Community Service Corps, will be among the tenants searching for a new home when the endowment funds Hillsborough Street buildings are raised, but he says it's a small price to pay. There is significant opportunity for substantive development on these properties and properties adjacent to them, Murison says. The university has put some skin in the game by purchasing and assembling properties on the street that's primed for redevelopment. Momentum for other development projects along Hillsborough Street is also building. Capstone Development is preparing to begin construction of the Stanhope Center, which will include, in the first phase, 277 multifamily units and a parking deck at the intersection of Hillsborough Street and Stanhope Avenue. Charlotte-based real estate developer FMW received rezoning approval in October for its planned $40 million multifamily and retail project on Hillsborough Street at West Morgan Street. FMW partner Jim Zanoni says the firm plans to submit a site plan in early 2011. Construction could begin as early as spring. Regarding the NC State proposal, Zanoni says the potential uses for the property are vast. I can see new dense residential development with both student housing and market-rate options, ground floor retail and commercial. I can even see the potential for a new hotel, he says. Because of the strength of that location, they have the luxury of multiple uses being candidates. Could FMW possibly be interested in the site? We could possibly be interested, Zanoni says. I definitely look at it as providing synergy along Hillsborough Street. Inside the front cover, Growing Salix May Serve Up Big Lease Deal by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Morrisville. Salix Pharmaceuticals is sending ripples through the Triangle's commercial real estate industry as company leaders consider whether to renew the lease at its headquarters facility in Morrisville or negotiate for larger space in a newer building elsewhere in the Triangle. So far, there's no indication that Salix is considering a move that would take it and its 400 employees outside the Triangle, but a move to Raleigh for the company, which develops and markets drugs for gastrointestinal ailments, could well be in the cards. Adam Derbyshire, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Salix, says the company is considering numerous options, including staying at its current location. When probed for details, Derbyshire wouldn't comment further on the company's office space needs. Salix representatives have been touring buildings with 75,000 to 100,000 square feet in the capital city that could provide expansion opportunities. Salix has occupied the 77,000-square-foot building at 1700 Perimeter Park Drive in Morrisville since mid-2005, when it relocated there from the Colonnade office project in North Raleigh. Now Salix executives could be considering a move back to Colonnade off Six Forks Road, if the deal is right, real estate sources say. The Colonnade 2 office building opened in 2008, but it was only 23% occupied, with 97,510 square feet of vacant space. In the third quarter, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey, the building is owned by Cornerstone Real Estate Advisors and Spectrum Properties. Salix, whose stock trades on the NASDAQ market, has been on a steady growth path since relocating to Raleigh from Palo Alto, California in 1999. It still maintains a small office in California, but most of its operations are in Morrisville. According to company and Wake County records, Salix still has a lease for fifth-floor suite of 26,000 square feet in the Colonnade 1 building that expires in 2011. Clinis Clinical Research Incorporated has been subleasing the space from Salix for several years. Salix lease with Indianapolis-based Duke Realty Corp., its landlord at Perimeter Park in Morrisville, expires in 2015, but the company has an option to terminate the deal at the end of the 77th month, which is in September 2011. Tenant representation specialist Ryan Tolan of the UGL Equus commercial real estate firm in Raleigh, who is not involved with Salix's real estate search, says it's hard to keep a 100,000-square-foot tenant search a secret. The reality is it creates enough leverage play to get Duke Realty's attention, Tolan says. It's still a tenant's market out there, and tenants their size are going to attract a lot of attention in our market. In July, Piper Jaffray analyst David Absalon upgraded Salix's stock with an overweight rating and a target price of $58 when the stock was trading around $41. Salix's stock closed at $45 a share on December 1st. Absalon noted that Xifaxan, Salix's top-selling drug for patients with hepatic encephalopathy and non-constipation irritable bowel syndrome, has seen continuous prescription growth since its launch in May. The drug is estimated to have more than $1 billion of sales potential. Xifaxan revenue for the third quarter of 2010 was $65.2 million, which was a 53% increase compared to $42.7 million for the third quarter of 2009. Next up, Ailing Portfolio will greet next Square One CEO, by Lee Westbecker. From Durham, the new chief executive currently being recruited to run venture bank Square One will have big shoes to fill and a nagging financial issues to fix. Losses on mortgage-backed securities the bank invested in as part of its capital core and against which it has made loans have been playing havoc with Square One's bottom line since 2008. And the pattern has continued into 2010, with the bank posting year-to-date securities losses of $30.1 million as of September 30, according to newly released figures compiled by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Net income through the same period was negative $12.5 million. The deepest 2010 trouble spot came on June 30th, when Square One reported a loss of $24 million due to its securities problems in the second quarter alone. At issue has been roughly $100 million of the bank's $700 million securities portfolio. These are financial instruments backed by home mortgages, some of which had ceased performing or were performing erratically, sparking diminished cash returns and write-downs. Amassing the large securities portfolio had allowed the five-year-old bank to ratchet up its assets and lending potential during the early going. When such assets go sour, a bank has the option of selling them off all at once or holding on to them on the prospect that the cash returns will improve over time, says bank analyst Don Coker. And how long it takes a bank to work its way through a portfolio problem depends on the severity of the problem, he adds. Square One founder and CEO Richard Casey, who passed away suddenly in November, was consistent in insisting that troubles with the securities portfolio were separate from the bank's basic model, which he said remained sound. Nonetheless, the job of cleaning up the asset is now left to the next CEO. With offices scattered across the country, Square One makes loans, sometimes for equity stakes in startup and emerging tech companies. Unlike many other banks during the credit crunch, It has continued to grow loans, deposits, and total assets, now at nearly $1.3 billion, up 23% from a year ago. In the wake of Casey's death, original investor and longtime board member Rob Mullenbeck has taken over as board chair, and the Square One board has appointed a committee of six top executives, including Casey's wife, Susan, who co-founded the bank with her husband, to run the operation while a search goes on to find a replacement. It won't be an easy job. Former Triangle venture capitalist Dave Bliven, now based in New Mexico, has been a longtime friend of the Casey's. Richard's great strength was his personality and ability to inspire people and paint a vision for the company and their investors on what the company would become, says Bliven, who adds that the successor should be a person with similar communication skills. In the short term, I think the organization has probably grown to the point that operationally, they can have great people in most positions and can continue to operate effectively. Others are not so sure. Other than saying the death was unexpected, the cause has not been revealed. Insiders say that since spring, Casey, who was in his early 60s, had been managing the bank online and was seen less frequently at the Square One offices at the American Tobacco campus. A committee of bank board members will search both inside and outside the bank for Casey's replacement. But the universe of candidates is small in the first place, since the boutique field of venture capital banking itself is exclusive. Dallas, Texas-based Comerica and Santa Clara-based Silicon Valley Bank are the institutions usually mentioned in the same breath with Square One as the leaders in the industry. There are a number of other banks that make it a practice of lending to startups, says analyst Nolan Christopher of Connecticut-based CRT Capital Group. But whenever the economy goes down, they tend to pull in their horns. Banks like Comerica and SVB stay in the game. Oysters, anyone? UNCW Hatchery Will Help Replenish North Carolina's Stock, by James Gallagher, from Wilmington. UNC Wilmington is gearing up to open its Shellfish Marine Hatchery, a research center that is intended to help repopulate the state's oyster beds that have been decimated over the past two decades. The $4.3 million facility is getting its finishing touches before researchers start testing out all the systems. Once that is complete, researchers will begin working to find ways to bolster efforts to rebuild the state's declining oyster population, says Amy Wilbur, the center's director. North Carolina's oyster population is less than 10% of what it was in 1900, says Clay Caroon, an oyster specialist with the State Department of Environment and Natural Resources Division of Marine Fisheries. The population has been decimated by over-harvesting, disease, pollution, and destruction of the bivalve's natural environment. Wilbur says it's hard to say which component has had the greatest negative impact on oysters. The loss of oysters, which tend to cluster in shallow waters, intercoastal waterways, and estuaries, has a substantial impact on the marine ecosystem. Oysters eat algae and help keep it in check, but that has become harder in recent years as pollution has allowed the algae to bloom. Once the algae dies naturally, it sinks to the bottom and begins to decay, sucking oxygen out of the water. Having sufficient numbers of oysters and clams to eat the algae before it dies helps keep the ecosystem healthier, says Wilbur. UNCW's hatchery will be able to produce thousands of oysters that can be released into coastal waters to help replenish the population. The hatchery will grow the oysters for about 2 months, during which time the oysters will start to develop their shells. They will then be released into the wild to finish growing. Oysters take about 18 months to 2 years to reach market size. Unlike fish, which can be grown entirely in tanks, oysters need a natural environment in which to grow. They swim around during the early parts of their lives before settling to the bottom of the ocean, where they attach to reefs and other solid surfaces. Oysters that settle on mud likely will sink into it and die. It is for that reason that oyster shells are now returned to the water rather than being used in driveways or coastal lawns. The shells provide something solid for the oysters to attach to. While performing this work, center researchers will try to understand the best practices for cultivating the mollusks, as well as work to develop specialized breeds of oysters that can grow faster and are more tolerant to the diseases and water conditions in North Carolina. Such advancements will be shared with those in the industry to propel the creation of private oyster hatcheries across the state. Dan Bodden, director for UNCW's Center for Marine Science, says the research discoveries will help create an economic machine for the state. About $1.6 million worth of oysters were landed last year in North Carolina, says Caroon. Right now, there are a few individuals working to cultivate and farm oysters. Jim Schwarzenberg owns J&B Aquafood, which is among the largest private oyster hatcheries in the state. For now, he relies on work done at research centers in Virginia to provide him with special oyster breeds. Schwarzenberg, who sits on the board at the UNCW hatchery, says he is optimistic the new facility will help promote the oyster hatchery business in North Carolina, as well as restore the populations. Next up, Brithaven proposes $10 million Holly Springs Nursing Home by James Gallagher. From Holly Springs, Raleigh's burgeoning suburb is again being targeted for a new healthcare facility, with Kinston-based Brithaven LLC proposing to build a nursing home in Holly Springs. The company, which owns or operates more than 50 nursing care facilities in North Carolina, Virginia, and Kentucky, wants to spend more than $9.6 million constructing a 90-bed nursing facility on 16.8 acres on Main Street. It would be the first such facility in the town, and one of the few in the southern half of the county. Brithaven is seeking a certificate of need from the State Department of Health and Human Services Division of Health Service Regulation to transfer certificates for 90 beds from its 180-bed City of Oaks facility at 3609 Bond Street in Raleigh to a new facility in Holly Springs. CON regulations are intended to limit health care cost growth by regulating capital spending on health care facilities and equipment. The Holly Springs facility would be constructed in a neighborhood configuration and feature private rooms, according to the CON application. Additionally, by moving the rooms from the City of Oaks facility, Brithaven would be able to renovate that facility and make more private rooms in Raleigh, the company says in its application. Such a move complies with the trends in the industry, says Craig Souza, Executive Director of the North Carolina Healthcare Facilities Association, the state's trade association for nursing care facilities. People would prefer to be in a private room, he says, adding that, as with hospitals, nursing care facilities have been transitioning to private rooms over the past several years. In recognition of that movement, there is an exemption in CON law that allows nursing care and adult care facilities to convert semi-private rooms to private, improve dining facilities, and improve common areas without filing for a certificate of need, so long as the number of beds stays the same and the work is done on the same site, says CON analyst Mike McKilpit. But Brithaven doesn't qualify, since it wants to relocate beds. A nursing home in Holly Springs would provide services in a growing portion of Wake County. Holly Springs, which currently has about 24,700 residents, is expected to grow to more than 31,000 by 2015. And the 55 to 64 age range has been the fastest growing sector. Carl Dean, Holly Springs town manager, says many of those individuals are following their children and grandchildren to the area. Holly Springs officials have been talking with Brithaven representatives about the proposal, and the town is supportive of the plan. This would be another thing that would enhance the health care here, says Dean. Not only are there no nursing care beds in Holly Springs, there are none in the Buckhorn and Panther Branch townships, which comprise a large portion of southern Wake County. Brithaven says in its application that the new facility would better distribute rooms across the county. Holly Springs has been the target for many new health care facilities in recent years. Rex Healthcare is in the process of constructing a physician's office building, an urgent care center there, while Winston-Salem-based Novant Health has won a CON to construct an ambulatory surgical center. Novant failed in its attempt to get state approval to build a hospital in Holly Springs. According to its CON application, Brithaven would borrow about $6 million to pay for the construction, with the remaining $3.6 million coming from its reserves. The company anticipates the facility would be up and running by 2014, with revenue during fiscal 2014 totaling $5.1 million and growing to $6.5 million in fiscal 2015. Net income would come in at a loss of $92,700 during its first year, but would turn black to $257,000 in fiscal 2015. Randy Uzzell, president of Brithaven, did not return phone messages and emails. Flowserve growing local ops on heels of $30 million China deal. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. Raleigh. Flowserve Corporation will expand its Raleigh valve manufacturing plant to meet demand created by a $30 million contract to supply parts for nuclear power plants in China. John Chappell, general manager of Flowserve's Raleigh operations, says an addition of 16,000 square feet to the 200,000 square foot factory will allow for the installation of new machine tools and provide more space for inspection, assembly, and testing. Flowserve employs 423 people at the Raleigh plant. Floyd Benzinger, product portfolio manager for Flowserve's nuclear-related valve products, says it's unclear how many new jobs will be created, but the company is bullish on its nuclear plant work. The valve products made in Raleigh range in size from 3/8 of an inch to as large as 40 inches. The new order from China, though, will require valve pieces that stand 20 feet high and weigh 57,000 pounds. It runs the whole gamut, Benzinger says. According to information from Industrial Reports Incorporated of Raleigh, Flowserve expects to begin construction at the Raleigh plant in December. Court Construction Incorporated of Apex worked on construction projects at Flowserve's plant in 2003 and in 2008, according to Wake County building permit data, but no one from the company returned calls for details. The Raleigh plant has been in operation since the late 1960s, when it was the Edward Valve Company plant. Irving, Texas-based Flowserve was created in 1997 when several valve, pump, and mechanical seal equipment companies merged. Flowserve acquired the flow control division of Invensys in 2002. The Invensys acquisition included the transfer of about 100 jobs to the South Raleigh plant at the time. Flowserve is now a Fortune 500 company. Its stock is trading at around $106 per share on the New York Stock Exchange. Between March 10th and November 4th, Flowserve announced 6 orders for specialized valves worth more than $30 million needed for the construction of the nuclear power plants in China. Most of the valves will be produced in Raleigh, the company states. The Raleigh plant also produces engineered products for customers in the oil and gas, chemicals, power generation, and water utilities businesses. The nuclear power business is one of the growth sectors for manufacturing, and we have demand from customers, says Flowserve spokeswoman Erin Stubbing. We need to make sure our facilities could keep up with that demand. That's what's driving the expansion in Raleigh. Flowserve has 21 manufacturing operations around the world, with 5 of them in the U.S. The company claims to be the third largest industrial valve supplier in the world. In 2009, it employed 15,000 people globally, of whom about 5,500 are in the U.S. Next up, private water company signals it wants another rate hike. Aqua North Carolina put in place a rate increase last year. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Cary. Aqua North Carolina customers who are still adjusting to a rate increase implemented just last year can expect another rate hike soon. The Cary-based water utility has filed notice with state regulators that it intends to file a rate case in December. Company President Tom Roberts says the increase reflects higher costs for supplies and materials as well as labor. But Roberts would not put a dollar figure on how much of a rate increase Aqua would seek. Quite frankly, we're not ready to file today, so there are some things that are moving and changing, he says. Aqua North Carolina is a subsidiary of publicly traded Aqua America, which is based in Pennsylvania. Aqua America reported third quarter net income of $43.8 million, up from $33.5 million a year ago. Third quarter operating revenue was $207.7 million. Aqua North Carolina last filed a rate increase in 2008, seeking to set a base rate of $16.61 per month. The North Carolina Utilities Commission did not give Aqua all it asked for, approving a base rate of $15.18. But the increase was substantial for some parts of Aqua's territory that had not seen rate changes in years, a reflection of the different legacy rates of various water utilities Aqua had acquired. The 2008 rate case established uniform rates throughout Aqua's North Carolina territory. Aqua North Carolina serves about 87,000 customer accounts in 42 counties, including Durham and Wake. When Aqua makes its rate filing, engineers from the Utilities Commission consumer arm, the public staff, will review the request. The money Aqua seeks to recover through the rate case has already been spent on various projects. In North Carolina, water utilities recover their investments in infrastructure after the fact. But Ken Rutter, director of the public staff's water division, says that just because Aqua incurred a particular expense doesn't mean the company is entitled to recover that cost from ratepayers. Rutter says that if, for example, Aqua spent $25 for a filter that should cost $12, the public staff can recommend approval for the recovery of only $12. Mary Grant, a researcher at Washington, D.C.-based watchdog group Food and Water Watch, says Aqua typically seeks a rate increase every year or two depending on the state. Some states don't allow annual rate cases. Grant says determining rates by reviewing a utility's historic expenses protects customers because it puts the risk on the utility. If a water utility were to project its expenses and seek regulatory approval up front, the utility would need to make many assumptions, Grant says. Utilities would build out the projects even if actual growth and needs fall short of projections. As a result, communities could end up paying for a treatment expansion and new water supplies that it didn't need, she says. As seen with the housing market, projections often can be overly optimistic. Aqua America has grown, acquiring 14 utilities this year. CEO Nick DeBenedictis said in a conference call to discuss third quarter results that he expects the utility will end 2010 with a total of 25 acquisitions for the year. Roberts says most of Aqua North Carolina's recent growth has been through developers adding new homes. But he says that in the current housing market, that growth has slowed. Next up, Credit Suisse ramping up Treasurer's Innovation Fund by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, Credit Suisse has commenced deploying cash from a $232 million fund set up by the State Treasurer's Office to inject capital into young North Carolina companies. To spearhead the North Carolina Innovation Fund, the giant investment bank, which runs a large back office, accounting, and reconciliation operation in Research Triangle Park, has brought in venture capital vet John R. Urin. Attempts to reach Urin for comment led to a Credit Suisse spokeswoman in New York who says he is not yet granting interviews about the new posting. He is too new with the company to be available, says the spokeswoman, Kat Herring. We'll be able to arrange interviews at a later date. Urin spent 8 years on the venture capital side working with Richmond, Virginia-based Harbert Venture Partners, one of the subsidiaries of $4.7 billion Harbert Management Corporation of Birmingham, Alabama, a wide-ranging investment shop that looks at an assortment of deals in private equity, mezzanine financing, and real estate. He is a UNC Chapel Hill-trained pharmacist who is still licensed to practice that trade in the state. While at Harbert, Urin specialized in life sciences and biotech, served on the board of InContact Surgical and other companies, and according to a Credit Suisse biography, is active with the technology transfer efforts of several universities, including UNC Chapel Hill, the University of Virginia, the Georgia Institute of Technology, and Duke University. At the Innovation Fund, which was announced by Treasurer Janet Cowell in March, Yuren will help oversee the deployment of cash in startup companies in areas that include healthcare, clean energy, and technology. He'll also be involved in making investments into existing private equity groups, including venture capital shops. So far, Credit Suisse has yet to say how much of the $232 million earmarked for the fund has been invested, or to elaborate on how the money will be split between early and later stage targets. The cash for the investments is to be drawn from the assets of North Carolina's pension system. The cash deployment phase of any mid-size investment fund isn't accomplished in a matter of months. Instead, says Charles Levy of Chapel Hill Investment Advisors, a former UNC endowment manager, it can take years to perform the due diligence needed and then to spread the cash. Here you may well be looking at 4 to 5 years to get all the money invested, Levy says. It was more than a year ago that Cowell issued a request for proposals in search of a manager for the investment fund. Credit Suisse beat out 7 other contenders for the job. Treasurer spokeswoman Heather Strickland says, winning the contract, Credit Suisse has committed $2.3 million of its own money to the Innovation Fund and through June had collected $608,542 in management fees from the state. Yuren will work with Lee Brashear, who works out of the Credit Suisse RTP office and who is part of the bank's 4-year-old Customized Funds Investment Group, or CGIF, which essentially sets up and then manages private label investment funds. Under the North Carolina organizational structure, CGIF will manage the Innovation Fund on behalf of the state's pension system. David Bass, managing partner of Raleigh-based Arena Capital, hopes the fund will be what's known as a patient investor, something he believes the region needs. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Arts Group serves the generations. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Educator Meg Revell joined the board of directors of Arts Together in the late 1980s and served a second stint in the 1990s. In 1993, at age 3, her oldest daughter started taking dance classes at Arts Together. She then volunteered as a counselor assistant teaching dance at age 14 and is now a modern dance major in college. And her son, who as a child took drama classes at Arts Together, now is a high school drama buff. One thing that makes us special is that we continue to attract generations of families, says Revell, who in November was named the organization's executive director. Arts Together has launched its inaugural annual fund campaign. While in the past it has raised money when it faced a particular need, such as a new piece of equipment, the organization has not run an annual fund drive. The board recognized the need to provide for the financial stability of the organization, says Joe Stewart, a board member, chair of its development committee, and associate vice president and director of the political education program at the North Carolina Chamber. Key to the effort will be recruiting 35 to 40 donors to give at least $500 each to qualify as members of a new leadership circle. Funds from the annual fund will be used to support scholarships, outreach programs in the community, and any educational infrastructure or software needs. Founded in 1983 and operating with an annual budget of $650,000 and a staff of 7 people, plus 25 teachers, Arts Together serves roughly 1,200 students from age 3 to their 60s through a preschool program, afternoon and evening classes, and summer classes and camps for teens and adult dancers. The main sources of financial support for the organization are the City of Raleigh, based on recommendations from the Raleigh Arts Commission, United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County, and North Carolina Arts Council. The group also generates revenue from tuition fees and receives support from individuals and corporations. Revell, who has taught graphic design at NC State University, Meredith College, and Peace College, and co-founded and is co-owner of Forma, a Raleigh-based strategic marketing firm, says her top long-term goals for Arts Together are to increase its visibility by telling its story, widen its reach, and nurture and develop collaborative partnerships in the community. In September, for example, Arts Together received $16,500 from the North Carolina Arts Council to train dance educators, dance artists, and others in a multidisciplinary approach to creating movement-based art for youth who have physical disabilities, developmental disorders, challenges with learning, or emotional or behavioral disorders. For the project, Arts Together will be fostering partnerships with the Arc of Wake County, Bug Creative Arts and Science Magnet Elementary School, Enloe High School, Governor Moorhead School for the Blind, and Mariposa School for the Children with Autism. The key, Revelle says, is to become known as the leader in arts education in this multidisciplinary approach. Next up, Pocatius Keeps on Cooking, by Frank Van Leeuwen, from Durham. On any given day, it's common to see Georgios Pocatius stroll into one of his restaurants, clutching something green in his hand. It's not money, though the restaurateur has made and lost plenty of that. Pocatius likes to carry fresh herbs. Sometimes he'll break off a piece and ask a guest to identify it. On this fall day, he's got a fistful of basil, and he carries it with purpose. "I have to get it before the first frost," he explains. Pocatius, CEO of the Georgios Group, is one of the Triangle's most prominent restaurateurs. By his count, he has opened more than 50 restaurants. Pocatius' current portfolio of restaurant is 9, including Bin 54 in Chapel Hill and Parizade in Durham. The Greek immigrant built his company with no formal food industry training. His education, he says, came as a teenager, washing dishes and bussing tables at his family's diner in Burlington. Pocatius opened his first restaurant, Pocatius Cuisine, in 1980. Success there led him to open more Triangle restaurants throughout the decade. But that rapid growth stretched Pocatius thin, and not all of his new ventures performed well. Forced into bankruptcy, he either sold or liquidated all of his restaurants, except for Parizade. Looking back, Pocatius says he grew too fast and held on to some restaurants for too long. The difference between the experienced restaurateur and the idealistic young man he once was is that he no longer lets himself get attached to any restaurant. In November, Pocatius closed Cafe Giorgio in Cary. Pocatius says he's looking for a new location. He says he will make changes to any restaurant and even sell when necessary. In this economy, many restaurateurs are being pressed into similar decisions. The U.S. restaurant industry lost 5,204 restaurants between the spring of 2009 and the spring of 2010, according to the research firm the NPD Group. Independent restaurants represented most of the losses, while chains held stable. Greg Starzynski, director of product development at NPD, says in the report that the figures reflect weaknesses in the industry due to lower customer traffic. Pocatius has diversified beyond running restaurants. His company has a consulting division that develops restaurant concepts for other restaurateurs. It also has a division that buys and sells properties. Annual revenue for the company tops $10 million. Kevin Summers, managing partner of Georgios Group, Girasol Trattoria, and the Gatehouse Tavern, first encountered Pocatius as a competitor. Summers co-founded Rocky Top Hospitality and worked there for 17 years before leaving in 2008. Summers says Pocatius' strength is his creativity in developing restaurant concepts suited to the consumer market and the economy. The lower prices of the Gatehouse Tavern, for example, reflect the preference of consumers to be economical. "There's a ton of restaurants he's opened. Some haven't worked," Summers says, "but his batting percentage is as strong as any in this market." Pocatius, who spent Thanksgiving cooking for actor Rob Lowe, offers no secret ingredient for success in the restaurant business. He says he was able to rebuild his company because he surrounded himself with people who could run the restaurants and manage the finances. "You have to hire better than yourself," he says. Now, Legal Focus, from Jim Verdonik. This article is titled "A Holiday Shopping List to Brighten Lives of Entrepreneurs. Nothing is too good or too expensive for our captains of industry." Tired of trudging through shopping malls? Don't know what to get your special captain of industry? Your problems are now solved. That you have my annual Christmas gift article to help you find the perfect gift for the businessman or woman who already has everything. Of course, nothing is too good or too expensive for our captains of industry. Alas, you'll rarely find my gift recommendations at the local mall, but my annual Christmas column proves once again the old saying that it's better to give than receive. I usually divide my Christmas article into naughty and nice list. This year, however, I've decided naughty and nice are too judgmental. Let's avoid judging others and instead attribute a bad year to the world of entrepreneurs and venture capital investors being dysfunctional. So, no coal in the stocking for bad investors, or candy canes for good entrepreneurs. This year's list is full of gifts that help restore functionality to a dysfunctional business world. Guts, as in courage, are the hot gift item this year. Stores just can't keep them on the shelves. Like gloves and sweaters, business people and investors put their guts away when the economy was warm and sunny. Now, when the economy is cold and stormy, they forgot where they hid their guts. Put them under their tree in case they never find them. Don't be caught without guts when you need them, and remember, the TSA is checking, so it's the perfect gift for business travelers. Companies seeking capital and venture capital investors have been yelling at one another like they're both hearing impaired. Hearing aids are the perfect gift for both entrepreneurs and investors. Warning, this gift doesn't come with a guarantee that they'll understand what they hear. Sorry to be the Grinch bringing bad news, but the elves that promised California VC investors green tax credits and carbon taxes went out of business. All they left was an IOU. Give your VC investors who loaded up on green is king companies books about investment diversification, government budgets, and capitalism to help them plan for a world without cap and tax. A big bottle of red ink will come in handy, too. For venture capitalists who didn't invest in any new companies during 2010, a year's supply of Viagra. See a doctor if check writing lasts longer than 4 hours. For entrepreneurs writing business plans that require raising $30 million. An alarm clock. Wake up. You're sleepwalking. For companies considering throwing in the towel after a bad year, a set of new towels and a DVD of the movie Rocky. For worried employees who are making everyone around them nervous, decaf coffee and a reminder that they survived another bad year. Stop worrying and relish being a survivor. For spouses of business people, thanks for taking seriously the, for better or worse, sickness and in health part of your wedding vows. For children of business people, a pen and a notebook. These times are teaching valuable lessons. Don't forget them. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a very functional New Year. Finally, the guest column by Steve Simanovich. The bad driver out there is us all. It's a sad commentary on modern life when we blame bad drivers for their bad driving behavior. We've all done it. A motorist cuts us off, runs a red light, or forces us onto the shoulder. We shake our fist and shout, "Where'd you get your license, Pet Boys?" This lack of compassion and regard for a fellow human being, quite possibly in pain, is nothing to crow about. We blame the victim. Yes, bad drivers are victims. It doesn't take a social scientist to see that they never got the nurturing they needed during their formative driving years. They may not have had a parent or guardian or even a neighbor with a clean criminal record to show them the proper rules of the road. Some shadowy figure crawled out of the woodwork and said to them, in essence, "Here are the car keys. Beat it." Bad driving cuts across all social and economic strata. Factory workers, appliance salesmen, corporate attorneys, investment bankers, Hollywood stars, and countless others all suffer from the same affliction of bad driver upbringing. I reflected on this sad fact as I sat in the passenger seat with my 16-year-old daughter behind the wheel. She had just gotten her driver's permit. My, how adult she looked with her adult clothing, adult hairstyle, adult physique, driving a car designed for adults. But then, "Whoa," I said, "that sounds like the bad driver rate. But my insurance policy wanted $2,000. What could I do?" But then I realized we're all in this together. We've run out of time today for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is another episode of the Triangle Business Journal and will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.